We're back again on Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric on YouTube Live, as well as Twitch. Glad to be back for another week. We've got a really good lineup set up for today. We're going into our last battle of the first round. The number four seed, which is Raging Bull, against the number five seed, Singing in the Rain. So Eric and I are going to be here to discuss these two titans. Eric turned on a filter, makes him look purple.
What is this? I didn't do this.
It's psychedelic look.
Why? Every week. I didn't do this. I don't have any reason. I don't know what I'm good looking enough already. I don't need this. Why
all is he doing this? All I can see is like a Jefferson Airplane from like the LSD, a bad LSD trip.
Why is this so dumb?
How did that happen? Uh-oh, he's froze again.
No.
Yeah, you're froze.
I'm here. I swear it's this webcam I bought.
Could be a webcam. I don't know.
I'm switching to a different webcam.
There you go. Oh, that one looks good.
That's the one that comes on the, you know, the computer. But I just thought, well,
I would get
so much about technology. I should buy more things that are complicated and weird and that I have to figure out. And I would say, Greg, so far, it's worked out really well. I was trying to IMDb Singing in the Rain and it wasn't coming up. And I was like, what
singing
am I doing wrong?
Singing.
Yeah, there it is. Real casual. Yeah, like
the apostrophe at the end. No G.
That's how you know that they're not taking themselves too seriously.
Yeah.
We're not singing.
Well, it is the final first round battle. We've made it to episode four and we've kind of narrowed it down. Last week, if you were with us, or even if you caught the replay on YouTube, the winner was by a resounding over Lawrence of Arabia was The Godfather. We both fully agreed. We did not have to go to an audience vote on that one. So we're moving now into kind of the almost to the final four. So if you look at the bracket right now, we've got the final four is Schindler's List, The Godfather, and Casablanca. And we're just waiting on the results of this final first round battle to get our final four up in there, and then we're just going to have one more episode to decide it all.
I wonder if Lawrence of Arabia would have gotten even a single vote had we just put it out into the world. I doubt it.
It's a good question because, I don't know. That's something we could maybe pose to the fan page and just say, would you have voted for Lawrence of Arabia over Godfather? I doubt it. Yeah, I think you're right.
It's the most out of place of all of them so far. But tonight we've got this weird, we compare these films and so far they've all been at least kind of like comparing Schindler's List to Citizen Kane was easy because there was some similarities that you could kind of pick through and there were enough differences where you could establish which one you liked more. These movies are so dissimilar, a Scorsese grime fest versus the feel-good movie of the century. And so it'll be interesting. And we'll get into the merits of each. And I believe that they both have plenty. But how we are going to get through this and vote on this, I'll be curious to see.
Yeah, you know, as I was watching both films, I actually watched them back to back and talk about juxtaposition and just messing with my head. I started with Singing in the Rain and then I went into Raging Bull. Now I've seen both before but it still was like went from this, like you said, a very upbeat, positive film, very funny, to this gritty drama. Gritty's a great word for it. You know, black and white. Somewhat depressing at times because of the way he self-destructs. But yeah, like I said, we'll get into each, but they're two starkly different films. But hey, and we want to thank everybody for viewing this, whether you're seeing it on YouTube Live for the first time or if you're on Twitch TV watching us. We want to thank you for being with us or checking us out Our views have gone up exponentially, both that and on the streams. So we want to thank everyone for tuning in on Spotify or whatever podcast provider you use to listen to us, because it's been nice to see that people are tuning in. So if you want to contact us about our categories, what we're going to do next after AFI's top eight films, you can email us at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. And those are the other two. The Twitch and the YouTube are down there as well. If you haven't followed us on those providers, please do so. Of course, you probably are watching on one of those right now. And it won't be long before we'll be on Facebook Live on our page, which will be nice. Right now, I stream on my personal page on Facebook Live, but would be
when
nice
are we
to
off,
be honest.
Off of SCOPRO?
It's supposed for to this. Be 60 days after the page is created. So we'll see. Hopefully soon. I think we started back, about end of July, mid-July. So should be good. But
thank
you.
That sounds right.
Yeah. So thank you all for tuning in. We got a great show tonight, but we are here on a Sunday. Normally we try to do Monday or Tuesday. So we're doing a Sunday night, keeping it a little bit different just so we can get these episodes in. So have you had a good weekend so far?
So I watched Singing in the Rain yesterday.
Okay.
And then unexpectedly, we ended up with none of our kids here at the house last night. And so what did I do?
Well, I know
what you not sure. watch Raging Bull. We packed up and went to the casino. It's about an hour up the road. We nice. Got a hotel and just blew a bunch of money. And it was really fun. A nice, unexpected trip with the old lady up to the casino. She loves a slot machine, Greg, and I love to see her having a good time.
That's good.
I slots are fine. You know, I recognize that it's the worst game you can play if you actually intend to make any money at a casino. That's fine, because I wasn't intending on making any. However, I will say that as much fun as that was, and we got back to our hotel about 3:30 this morning and went to bed and then got up and drove back down from Oklahoma. It was probably the right mood for watching Raging Bull, because I was kind of a hungover mess earlier today. But yes, we had a good time. The kids had a good time. They spent the night with their cousins. Everyone down here, Greg, you probably don't know this because your kids are grown. It is back to school time.
Right.
And so all of the kids are kind of in various states of, some go back tomorrow, some went back last week. My kids don't go back until a week from tomorrow, but we're getting in those final sleepovers before the new school year starts. So Eller into fourth grade, Greer kindergarten nice. This year.
Nice.
It is going to be a whole new world, a new fantastic point of view when both of them are gone all day and just quiet, Greg, just quiet.
Yeah, no, I haven't. They'll dealt with that in a very long time.
I'm sure at some point you miss the chaos that comes along with the kids being little. And I already feel some sense of, you know, looking back fondly on when they were younger, but it's pretty exhausting. And so about this time of summer, when it's 106 degrees outside here and there's nothing for the kids to do outside, which means they're stuck inside, which means they're unhappy. It's about this time of summer where I go, school would be great. In any event, how was your weekend, Greg?
Actually, similar. Yesterday, I went to play golf with a buddy of mine, and we played a local course, a community course here. I absolutely love it. Both times I played there, I've shot under 80. I had a really good day again. And then we went to the German Fest. His wife is German, and so she works with the German Council in downtown Dayton. And so we went to the German Fest and had a blast. And because I was partaking of beverages on the golf course and then got to German Fest and continued doing so until 8 o'clock at night. By the time we left, my wife was, it was like I was Rain Man. She had my arm and was walking me back to the truck. And I was like thanking her for taking care of me. I'm like, it just all of a sudden hits. Like you don't get drunk right away and you feel fine. And then all of a sudden you're not. And that's how it kind of was. I was there, and then I was not. So like you said, I no bourbon today. I've been in the same mood. And so, yeah, we watched the movies as well today. My wife, we'll get into Raging Bull in a minute, but she looked over at me during Raging Bull, and she went, "So what number on the top AFI is this movie?" And I said, four. And she looked at me and just went,
"Mm-mm." She doesn't approve. Old lady Lee, not a fan of Raging Bull.
No, and well, yeah, it's more of that's a guy's an interesting movie.
One. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just saying, it's more of a guy's movie, really. I don't see how many women, like we talked about when Jarrett Goes to the Movies had the Mafia Week or the gangster movies, and women just don't tend to get into that. And this one, even though it was boxing, it was had the similar vein.
You think it was
film.
The statutory rape that she was uncomfortable with, or do you think it was the domestic violence?
Yeah.
Or the insane jealousy of our, I guess, protagonist, although we're going to get into how I feel about this Jake LaMotta character later. I don't even know which movie we're starting with tonight. Which one are we starting
with? We are starting with Singing in the Rain, because it is the lower seed. And we're going to, I could actually go on about this movie quite a bit. I will start by saying with about Singing in the Rain was when I was a kid, I would watch, if I watched any old movies, it was usually Westerns, just because when I was a kid, that was kind of fascinating to me, or sci-fi, you know, that kind of thing. So I watched John Wayne, I watched, you know, Gary Cooper and all those when I was growing up. If anything I watched, that's what I would watch. And I stayed away from musicals. And my mother liked like the Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff, you know, the King and I, Oklahoma. Well, it wasn't for me. And I don't remember the first Gene Kelly musical I saw. And it might have been Singing in the Rain. And I was like, you know, 11 or 12, you know, and just on my own little TV in my room. And it was so different than those other grandiose stories where it was more of the common man stuff where he plays this kind of everyman character. And I went, oh, so musicals can be a little bit, you know, entertaining and fun.
Yeah.
You know, in the writing, and usually like he always had like a comic relief guy with him that was always hilarious. And this movie has that. So it became like Gene Kelly was kind of, I didn't watch a lot of musicals growing up, but man, if a Gene Kelly one was on Anchors Away and American in Paris, I would stop and watch it. I think he's just an amazing dancer.
He is impossible to take your eyes off of. I saw this for the first time yesterday.
Yeah.
I, within 5 minutes, just had this smile, grin on my face. Kelsey had walked outside to use the phone, like, right as the movie started.
Yeah.
And she walked in a few minutes later, and I was like, this is so great. And they hadn't even got, I think I had only got to, they start interviewing our lead on the red carpet.
Right.
And so the movie goes into, he starts out describing how he got his start in Hollywood. And from that moment, it's so funny, so tongue-in-cheek. He talk, what does he always say? It's
dignity,
not integrity.
Dignity. Always dignity.
I've had my dignity. Meanwhile, they show him, you know, doing vaudeville acts and getting the hook off of the stage and just all of these things where he's clearly in an undignified situation. It was so great. I mean, you talk about an it factor or just someone with a, well, Greg, the kids these days would say someone who has that riz. Have you heard this? Yeah, that riz?
Yeah, I hear you.
It means charisma from what I understand.
Oh, is that, thank you. I was going to ask. I was afraid to ask because it would show that I didn't know what
very, I mean, there's a lot of things I don't want to know from my teenager and from Eller and what he learns from her and from his older cousins and whatnot. But yes, Gene Kelly has that riz.
Yeah.
I would say you're just drawn to him. I this is the only movie I've ever seen of his.
Yeah.
But it would make me want to seek out more if he has that type of quality about him in other films.
Like I said, I can watch a musical. My wife likes what Wife Doesn't, The Sound of Music, and My Fair Lady, mm-hmm. things like that. And those are fine. But if I watch a Gene Kelly, I am in much more of an enjoyment mood. So I would recommend checking some of the others out. This is probably the best one, but On the Town is really good. It's about three Navy guys that come in for shore leave. There's Brigadoon is probably my second favorite, is where he's in Scotland and he finds a town that only materializes once every 500 years. And so they end up in this old Scottish town. It's like this fantasy musical. It's really, really good. It's all Scottish stuff. So it's pretty interesting. But this one is, yeah, this one's probably the peak. And so if this is your first one, it's a great one to start with. And it's just, what I love about the movie, and the best way I can describe it to people, it is meta before meta was even a thing. Yep. It makes fun of the movie industry in a way that's also endearing. But like you said, when they're introducing all the actors at the premiere and they all have these stereotypes, even for today, the weirdness, the woman, yeah. the woman that's marrying again and her husband is like 80 years old. Maybe it'll work this time.
This is and a picture of excitement here.
Yeah.
And he's just so grumpy about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's so tongue in cheek and plays on all of the kind of stereotypical tropes that you see in Hollywood. The arranged relationship for publicity's sake plays a big role in this. And we've seen current actors and actresses accused of, you know, well, this is all just for show, for publicity to sell something to the rest of us. So that was a big part of it. Like you said, this sidekick of his as a comic relief, although the whole movie's funny, but this guy just plays a really great, what's his name,
Donald O'Connor the is the regular actor and probably his best sidekick of it. There, granted, he's had other movies where Frank Sinatra is in there really good as a sidekick and other films, but yeah, Donald O'Connor was already known for being a really great stage performer, and Gene Kelly really wanted to work with him. And he just puts on an amazing show. So the actors, first of all, it's amazingly well cast. So you're talking about like the meta aspect where they're going into the actors in their personal lives, but they're peeling back the curtain into an era of the transition from silent film into talkies. And you get this kind of thing when it was so parallels. It's something that would easily work today because it does this really genteel way of making fun of themselves, and it just seems to click. And one of the things that makes it click is the cast from Donald O'Connor and Debbie Reynolds. She's just amazing. She's so amazingly cute is what's
I only know Debbie Reynolds as Carrie Fisher's mom.
Yes,
really. I mean, she's so pretty in this film.
Yep.
Like so incredibly pretty and funny and charming. And just, I enjoyed this so much. It came on and I didn't know what to expect. Now, I'm not, I like musicals. The ones you mentioned, I like Sound of Music. I've seen Oklahoma before. And one of my favorite films is maybe slightly outside of the specific musical genre, maybe a nouveau, but Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge is one of my favorite movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
And so, but I see it's rated G and it's from 1952. And I'm going, I mean, I'm not sure. Are the jokes going to hold up?
Yeah.
Is this plot going to hold up? Yes, the jokes hold up. There were so many one-liners that I found so clever that were just said in passing. They don't wait for you as an audience to kind of process what you heard. There's no, you know, like laugh track where you have room to kind of wait and let the joke hit you. There were plenty of one-liners from a lot of the cast that held up. Like you said, the dancing, I mean, obviously Gene Kelly is kind of known for his trying to bring modern dance into the mainstream, mm-hmm. right? He had schools, I think, and it was just kind of a big part of who he was, like dance education, dance as a form of art, and boy, is it ever with him. He starts, and it's impossible to allow your eye to move away from him. It's so graceful and fluid, and I just sat there going, listen, I am one of the world's top five worst dancers. I'm not afraid to admit it. And I just sit there and go, how do you learn to do this?
Yeah.
How does one, I know that there's a natural talent to it, but it also takes hard work, but like the things he does, the way he moves, it was stunning. I was really impressed.
Yeah, from everything that I know about Gene Kelly is that he was a known perfectionist that demanded everyone around him to be able to dance as well. And some interesting things about the Debbie Reynolds, who plays Kathy Seldon, they wanted her for this movie. She was 19 years old when she got the film, and she hadn't done much work, but she wanted this film really badly. She got it because of her Girl Next Door look, and she plays that to the hilt. She didn't know how to dance. Now, you watch the movie.
So I was watching the good morning
yes.
dance, and then there's one right after it.
Yeah.
And then I read that she wasn't a trained dancer before the film. Now, she was an athlete. She was a gymnast, apparently.
Yes.
But I'm going, how could you learn all of that in, I bet it took them a day to film that sequence.
They said that the Good Morning dance alone, they did 50 times at least.
Oh, my God.
And it was because Gene Kelly wanted everything to be snappy and on point and unison. Donald O'Connor was a really good dancer, so he knew he had that. And so there's always these stories because she was hard to work with because she was new at it. But Gene Kelly did say that she was very good at imitating. So he could show her something and she would pick it up. But he admittedly was extremely hard on her as a 19-year-old. There's a story of where Fred Astaire, who was filming another movie, found her crying under a piano in between takes because she was so distraught. Plus the fact that she was commuting like 80 miles to get to the studio. Jeez. There was nights where she would just sleep on the lot because she didn't want to have to go back and forth. She was living with her parents. So, Carrie Fisher's mother had a interesting start to her career. Of course, she became a very prominent actress. And of course, we all know the story after that, the dysfunctional relationship with Carrie Fisher after, she was born. So, but in this film, I couldn't see anybody else playing it, the part, because she really typifies the girl next door with talent. I love the meet cute where he jumps into her car to get away from fans. It's something that's copied today with the, they don't like each other at first because she's a bit snooty, but she's only being snooty because she doesn't want him to know that she's a fan. It's a great moment. And then, of course, he gets to the party and he's kind of ticked off that she's said all these things to him. It's hurt his pride. And then she pops out of the cake and it's just brilliant. It's just a hilarious moment where he gets his comeuppance and they start down this road of going back and forth. And then, of course, she ends up incurring the wrath by trying to throw a cake at him. She incurs the wrath of, in my opinion, one of the top 10 greatest movie villains that I can recall. Like this, you love to hate. And that's
Lena?
Yeah, Lena Lamont, played by Gene Hagen. And she is so good as a bad guy.
But she didn't see, to me, she took a heel turn like halfway through the movie. At the first part, she was just minding her own fucking business.
Oh, but she
is a movie star. Yeah. She, the way they set up this, we have to transition from silent pictures to the talkies.
Oh, yeah.
And so for those of you who haven't seen it, so Lena Lamont is, the world's foremost silent movie star, and that suits her really well because the first time you hear her voice it's like this shrill, like think of Fran Drescher in The Nanny, but it's higher pitched than that, and it's so off-putting. And you see the conflict starting to develop that we have to find a way to move this lady with one of the world's worst voices into talking pictures. And so that sets you know, part of our plot moving along.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Kathy Seldon jumps out of that cake, and then later when they're looking for her and Cosmo says, "We've looked in all the cakes all over town. Can't find her."
Yeah, that's great. But it is good because, yeah, like you said, they do this really great thing. And I loved how they're doing silent films. They're at the top of the heap, and then talkies come out. And I love how everybody's like, "Oh, it's going to be a flop. The Jazz Singer will never work." And then he goes, "Yeah, they said that about the Horseless Carriage too." But so then they have to learn how to act, which is brilliant because you get this Gene Kelly's kind of self-conscious about, will he be able to do it? And then they realize that they can't do it with Lena Lamont. But there's a scene, I've got a clip for it that will explain what Eric is talking about. There's the scene where Lena is with her coach, her vocal coach, trying to learn how to act in films. And it's just, this is kind of like, if you're going to show somebody to explain that, this is a clip. So let's take a look.
"Now, ta te ti to tu.
Ta te ti to tu.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line."
"And I can't stand him."
"And I can't stand him."
"And I can't stand him."
"Can't."
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 She does such a great job.
It reminded me a lot of the professor scene in My Fair Lady, where they're doing the rain in Spain thing. But this was I think that other scene is more famous than this one, but I really thought this one did a better job of just being funny and just getting, and that "I can't stand them" comes back later too, when she has to. So the whole transition from not just the stars of silent pictures to becoming real actors and actresses in talking pictures, but the way you make movies is different, right? And so we also get to see a bunch of the problems that they have, the film crew, in microphone placement. I got such a kick out of that scene where they have placed a microphone, but she can't manage to always speak into it, and so the sound would and then she would come back towards the mic, and that was so good. I don't expect things that are now 70 plus years old to just be funny. I just think humor has evolved enough. I think it's just different.
Yeah.
But I laughed so much at this. This comedy will be funny 100 years from now.
Yeah.
Because of just how well it was done, the writing, how good it was, which is crazy because from what I read, they only put this movie together to try to get rid of this back catalog of songs they had piling up. And so what do we do with all these songs? Well, let's just make a movie out of them. And to start off with such a uninspired, you know, way to, it wasn't something they were passionate about. They have a songwriter on staff and they need to get rid of some of these songs.
The interesting story about that is that they knew what they had to do, so they rented a house in the Hollywood Hills and so that they could all work together, the screenwriters, and it belonged to an old silent film star who had lost his career when the talkies came around because he couldn't act. And so there was some memorabilia, there was some story behind it, and then it just went, just that light bulb went off when they were like, that's the movie.
Oh, they hadn't had the framework at all for that part of it.
They were getting ready to start writing a script. They didn't know where they were going to go with it. They were going to base it around the songs. So then they're able to incorporate this brilliant script because they wrote an amazingly funny script, very talented with where the plot is, the romance is good. Everything is good about this film. And so, yeah, it stands the test of time that they were able to put this together like that, because it really shows in the result. I've watched it hundreds of times over the years of the course of my life, and it never gets old. I never stop laughing at it. The scene that you mentioned, watching it again today, the scene where they finally, after trying so many times to get the microphone to work, and they put it on her shoulder. Yeah, on her shoulder, so she's kind of tethered to it, and then the producer walks in and goes, "Who put this cord here? That's dangerous." And he pulls it out and just whips her off of her chair. I still laughed out loud at that moment. It is one of those things that catches you off guard, and it's hilarious. It's a great sight gag. It works really well.
One-liners, physical comedy, a story within a story, multiple layers of comedy. I found it so great. I mean, we get a pie in the face in this film. You know, if there's anything, you know, that people have been doing that since vaudeville, right? And we get one, and you don't roll your eyes at it and go, how stupid, how cliche, how lazy. Like, it just works so great.
Yeah.
It's such a skill and care taken to, I mean, I guess, like you said, Gene Kelly being probably not only a perfectionist when it comes to dance and movement and choreography,
right,
but probably that carries over into, because he directed this, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I'm sure that carried over. It was just, there are movies that can be good in spite of some of the technical aspects of the film.
Right.
This isn't one of them, because they just nailed it. It was just so great. I found myself, there's a dance number with Gene Kelly as Don, mm-hmm, and Cosmo, where I was about to Google like high-waisted trousers and brown V-neck sweater. Like, I wonder if I could pull that look off today. Yes. How do you have a perfect...
I'm always prepared.
How does this keep happening?
Always prepared with the images. Yeah,
I see this and I'm like, I wonder if I could pull that off today, because my God, what a timeless classic. Those high-waisted trousers, the merino sweater.
Yeah.
So great.
And let's give it up to the guy who plays the vocal coach. As the straight man, he is utterly... If you watch him while they're doing all the dancing... And his reactions, and when they grab him and they start pulling him around, he's really funny. He goes rigid as a board. They lay him down on the desk, and his legs are sticking out. He was brilliant. But yeah, they have the vocal coach, and it leads into a song and dance number. But it's probably one of the best numbers in the film, especially one of the best tap dance numbers with him and Donald O'Connor. They really pull off an amazing scene, and it's very cool. And it's funny to say that, you know, 1950s, but it's a cool dance number.
Yeah.
It's
timeless. It's cool. Greer looked up from her tablet when they start, you know, the clickety clack, 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 you know, and yeah. I was like, well, that's tap dancing. It made me think about these arts that are probably considered archaic now. Mm. I think of like Appalachian clogging, mm-hmm, you know, or square dancing, tap dancing. I know that Greer even took, you know, toe and tap. You know, a lot of little girls take dance class and, you know, go out there in their tutus and do a little tap dance number. But the number of people who carry that passion on into adulthood, you know, we all know, like, what is it, Gregory Hines, tap dancer. But that's like the last person I can think of that took it seriously. I know that there are others out there. No one has to email me a list of the world's most prominent current tap dancers. Okay.
Right.
I'm just saying that there was a time where you could throw a rock and hit somebody who knew how to do it, could do it well. And right now it's just such a lost art. You know, it felt very sad to me as I watched that number and just go, that is the kind of thing that we just won't see anymore. It'll be gone soon enough.
We have, you know, decent modern day musicals. I really liked Chicago when it won all the awards. I thought it was a great mm-hmm movie, and it had some really good dancing in it. And if you go to like a Broadway or off-Broadway show, you'll get a little bit of a mixture of that. But that's only the place it's only really residing. We don't have, like you said, like a Gregory Hines used to go on TV and tap dance on a variety show. And it would be like everybody would stop and watch him because he was so damn good. But yeah, we don't have that art anymore. But it's so it's nice to have these films to look back on and reflect. And there's so many great scenes. And you can't talk about Singin' in the Rain without the most iconic scene. And if you've not only watched it in clips or only seen pictures, if you've not seen his Singin' in the Rain actually, there's a reason why this image is iconic. It's because the dance and the everything that he choreographed with it is iconic. It's so much fun to watch. It's the idea that they just finished, you know, doing the Good Morning thing. They come up with the idea to let Kathy do Lena's voice so that they can get over that hump and get the movie made that they're trying to fix because it was a disaster. That scene, don't want to get too much into that. The scene where they do the screening is a hilarious scene with the sound going out of whack and everything.
Yep.
But so it comes down to that. And then after that's over, they kind of declare their love for one another. And he is out in the rain and he's the happiest he can be. And it feels like it. It feels so genuine that he's so happy he's singing in the rain. It's amazing.
There is a joy to his performance. And just like you said, it became a joy for me to be watching it.
But, you know, that's the thing is if I go back to that time, if I was going to be a dancer, I would want to be like Gene Kelly. That's who I would want to emulate as far as a hero. Compared to everybody else that I've ever seen dance in the history of Americana, is Gene Kelly. So this scene is so amazing. This whole musical number. And the funny thing was that he had like 100-degree fever when he filmed it, and they filmed a lot of takes. He had the flu, but they had a schedule. They had to get it done. And just to know that he had 100-degree fever plus.
Yeah.
And he did as well as he did. There was also another crazy story about it that I read was where when they first went to film it, they decided to do it in the afternoon. And everybody in the LA area had come home from work and all ran their sprinklers at that time. And they had no water pressure. So they were like, well, we're going to have to do this in the mornings, it looks like. But yeah, an amazing scene. It's so loved that I actually pulled this up. Look at that, almost identical. Pulled this up. This is a statue in Leicester Square in London that is an homage to Gene Kelly that you can find and take in because they absolutely adore the film over in the UK. And yeah, it's just that one of those things that stands the test of time. So the fact that this statue is still there, people still get photographs with it, show you the enduring love of this film, no matter that it was made in 1952.
So I think it can be, and I'm not saying that I agree or disagree. I think that there are people who think that seeing really good male dancers could be considered or comes off as feminine in some ways. And he is the opposite of that. Like, you're watching a man move so gracefully, but it never comes across as feminine or, you know, anything less than just a masculine, happy man who's, you know, found love, who the contrast between how he's feeling and the dark set and the rain, and it's just done so well. This whole thing stands the test of time because apparently the Pittsburgh Pirates, and Gene Kelly is from Pittsburgh, still play Singin' in the Rain during rain delays for their baseball game. I knew Singin' in the Rain. I did not know that Good Morning was from this film. So that was another one that I already knew. And there was one other number that I knew before I knew that it was from this. I don't recall which one.
Make them laugh. That's probably, to me, one of the best funny song and dances. And I posted on our Facebook page today, earlier story about that, was that Donald O'Connor used to do that back on the stage where he did the running. That's really him doing that stunt where he runs up the wall and does a backflip. And the day they shot it over and over again. And by the end of it, he was like a chain smoker. He smoked 4 packs a day. He was nearly dying and he collapsed. And they had to take him to the hospital, and he's in the hospital. He gets back to the set, and Gene Kelly goes, "Hey, you know the make them laugh sequence. Are you able to do that one more time?" And he's like, "What?" He goes, "Well, we had a problem with one of the lenses. They fogged up, and it damaged all the reels of film where he had done that nearly put him in the hospital." So
that's a real story, he was just giving him a hard time?
No, they really lost the film, and he had to do it all over again, which is just crazy. But it's a great sequence. The movie has so many good moments like that. I love movies where I can say there's not a wasted moment. There's not a moment in the film that you feel compelled to look at your phone because you might miss something. There's a lot of movies these days and in the older days that it can drag, like Lawrence of Arabia, where it can drag and you start checking your phone and you start getting a little distracted, you know, especially these days where we have a million screens to look at. But this film never feels that way. Even the Broadway Melody montage, I'm captivated by.
Okay, so I was, if I had, I were forced to pick a nit.
Yeah.
Boy, this went on just longer than my attention span would allow.
I disagree on that. I mean, maybe it's because I've watched it a few times and I enjoy it for what it is. It's almost like a modern day music video. It's a story within the story that they filmed with the sequence, maybe to fill out the running time.
And yes, so it felt like that because it seemed a little segregated from the rest of the film.
You could cut it out and it wouldn't miss anything except for the fact that it has some great dance numbers in it. Sid Charisse, who is actually also in Brigadoon, by the way, up in the top left corner of the picture there, she was a longtime partner of Kelly's. He really loved her dancing. And the plan was this sequence was supposed to have Debbie Reynolds play the femme fatale, but it just didn't work. And the fact that the dancing was too intricate, Gene Kelly didn't think she could do it. So he called in Sid Charisse, who's somebody that was like his go-to, his backup, and they arranged to do this sequence with her. So it gave him a chance to put her in the film. It's a separate from it. Yeah, you can do without it if you don't like it, but I love the visuals of it. I love the treadmill area where he's dancing on the treadmill and people are going by. I just like the gotta dance stuff. I like the different things. So yeah, you can go with or without it, but I still think it's perfectly fine left in.
Yeah, I liked it. There, it just as it got to the end of there, and it's kind of like kind of a cliffhanger because we've worked our way pretty far into, okay, well, we have to figure out how to be actors. We have to figure out how to film this. Okay, it's a bunch of hijinks. It's bad. Okay, well, we've developed a plan. Okay, we've put the plan in motion. Okay, we've been more or less successful with that. And then 25 minutes of unrelated dance. And then back into our, like, you know, resolution and denouement. And it's like, okay. I mean,
yeah.
If we needed three more numbers.
Yeah. And maybe that's what it was. They had Broadway Melody and that they wanted to throw in there. And they didn't know where to put it. So Gene Kelly probably proposed. I mean, I could probably look it up, but, you know, hey, why don't we just do this? We'll do a dream sequence or where we're explaining what's going to be in the movie and we film it. It's enjoyable. If you take it and just watch it outside of the film, it's perfectly enjoyable. But you're right. It does take away from where they're going at in the film, because then right after that is where we have Debbie Reynolds doing all the lip syncing for Lena Lamont, and then she gets caught, and then it like really ramps up because then she goes into full villain mode. She's going to extort the studio to make sure that she stays being her vocal understudy. One of the interesting things that some people may not know about this film is that when Debbie Reynolds, Kathy Seldon, is doing the vocals for Lena Lamont, played by Gene Hagen, it's actually Gene Hagen's real voice that you hear and not Debbie Reynolds, because Debbie Reynolds had a higher pitched, you know, more girly sounding voice. And they wanted the Lena Lamont character, when she's overdubbed, to have this rich, beautiful voice, which Gene Hagen had in real life. So it's Debbie Reynolds dubbing Gene Hagen, dubbing Gene Hagen.
That is so funny. Yeah, I hadn't read that.
Yeah, but it's a crazy thing that they did. And it works. And of course, one thing about Gene Hagen, everything that I've read about her, she's like, and the best villains usually are, one of the nicest people. She had a beautiful voice. She was very, she was just somebody that people really liked being around. So just the fact that she plays one of the best villains is amazing to me. I really enjoy her performance a lot. When I watch this film, her voice, the way she carries herself, she's funny, and it works out really well.
Yeah, to play a role like that, that has, I mean, she's a villain, right? And she plays it hard and tough in the later acts, but it exposes a vulnerability, even though it's not true. Right. You know, in real life, she's kind, she's very talented, she's a great singer, her voice isn't shrill and crazy, yeah, and you know, all of these things, but I think you almost probably have to be a good-natured, kind of kind person to play a role that is vulnerable like that.
Right.
I mean, I say that. I'm sure we could name plenty of jackass pieces of shit actors, you know, who have played these amazing roles, and you wonder how they could ever be so awful in real life.
Yeah.
Like every Tom Cruise role he's ever done. We're gonna get sued, aren't we? We're gonna get shut down the whole show.
You just took on Scientology, so thank you very much. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
The good thing we're not big yet, because they won't shut us down until we get a good following. So we're working on that.
My attorney will be in touch. I was talking to my dad yesterday. Oh, my dad met us at the casino last night, because he lives right by it. So he hung out for a little while, then he left Kelsey and I to, you know, our own devices. And I was talking about that we had the show today, and we were talking about the movies, and he kind of gasped and was like, I just love Singing in the Rain. And so I got a text message from my dad like 20 minutes ago, and it's apparently his TV, and he's rewatching Singing in the Rain today. So
awesome. Yeah, it is. That's one of the things how I judge a great film, too. And I've said this before. It's similar to like a great meal. You know, we watch cooking shows a lot, and that's where I kind of get this analogy from. And one of the things when they're judging meals, they always say, would I order that again? Mm-hmm. And this has one of that. I would order this again and again and again, and I wouldn't get sick of it. Now, granted, I'm not going to watch it every day, but watching it every other year or so and just putting it on, or if it's on, just stopping and watching it. There's nothing wrong with that. It is a feel-good movie for sure. It's not deep. It's not good. Other than the meta thing, which I think is done extremely well, it's not going to win any awards for drama. It's not going to be anything existential or anything symbolic. It's just a movie that is feel-good. It's a popcorn movie that you can share with your kids, you know, and you can share with anybody and just enjoy. So, yeah, it does. It works extremely well. I was glad that it was on the list at number 5, and I was happy to watch it again, and I'm glad that you got a chance to see it, because
I am too. I've really enjoyed the whole experience of watching. I mean, you know, these are, whether we agree with the rankings or not, the 8 best movies of all time, and for me to have only ever seen one of them, you know, is kind of crazy. So, as a whole, having done it this way and started with this group of movies has been very fulfilling for me. But this one specifically, it was just so pleasant.
Yeah.
Like you said, joyful. And, you know, yes, like every good movie, there's a conflict, but it never felt overwhelming. It doesn't take away from, you know, maybe you're the kind of person who too much of that feels stressful, takes away from your enjoyment of a movie. It doesn't do that. It's just a device to present a story and to present song and to present dance. And we only barely touched on it in that Singing in the Rain scene, but the sets.
Oh, yeah.
And the costuming, colorful and vibrant, and you know, was almost like another character in the film. It was so visually interesting and unique. Maybe it wasn't unique. You know, I guess I haven't watched a bunch of 1950s musicals of the era.
Right.
But it, for someone who's not familiar with that type of movie from that period in time, I just kind of, like I did with Gone with the Wind, just kept looking around at everything going on the screen because it's so interesting looking, vivid, vibrant, you know, the movement, the songs. I'm a musician, so that resonates with me. It all came together. Yeah. And I just had this silly, dumb grin, you know, as I watch a G-rated 70-year-old movie and just having the time of my life. It put me in such a good mood.
Yeah, it does do that. The MGM, like, Technicolor era was a really great one for musicals. But this one, I think it does, it did up the mark for all of them. And it didn't win any awards. I think it was nominated for a couple. I think Donald O'Connor and Gene Hagen were nominated, which is, and it was nominated for like best music, which is a shame. But I think back then they weren't giving musicals, you know, because there were so many of them. They didn't win a lot of awards. But this one, its use of color, like you said, the contrasting, the bright, vibrant colors are they don't, they're not loud. They don't get in your, they just add to it. Even the details, like in the Good Morning sequence when they're dancing with the raincoats, they pick those for a reason. They each raincoat contrasts. They look shiny. They stand out. And so it just works. The whole Good Morning sequence, that set in that mansion, you know, that big house, wherever it is that they build for the sequence, it works really well. The dancing up and down the stairs is phenomenal. So, yeah, I agree. It is a definitely feel-good movie, and it's something that it will be around for a long time. And I will keep watching it until I can't watch anything anymore, and I'm drinking through it, eating all my meals through a tube, and then I still might watch it.
Drinking all my bourbons through a tube.
Yeah. Mixing that in all my pureed foods with a little bourbon in it. So that, now let's take things down a notch as far as like the feel good. We're going to take the feel good completely out, and we're going to talk about the number four seed that Singing in the Rain's taken on, and that is Raging Bull. Robert De Niro plays Jake LaMotta, the middleweight champion in the late 40s, early 50s, and his, based on true story, of course, based on LaMotta's own autobiography. And it,
I do often wonder if Jake LaMotta is a reliable narrator when describing his own life.
Well, it doesn't pull any punches. I mean, you have to wonder, as much as they show in the film, you have to wonder, did he hold anything back? Because holy smoke, he was involved with Scorsese, and so he did talk about his own struggles and his own shortcomings, if you will. That's a polite way of putting it.
I have a tendency of doing this, and I want to talk to you about it because I wonder if you experience the same phenomenon. Mm-hmm. When you watch a movie like this or any other media, think Breaking Bad, where the lead character is not someone who has any redeeming qualities to speak of, or very few to speak of, it seems to me that in situations like this, I, for some reason, want to give them the benefit of the doubt because the story's about them. Mm. You know, I end up rooting for Walter White in Breaking Bad. In this one, I wasn't rooting for Jake LaMotta because he's pretty despicable, but were he not the main character of this, I would just hate him. Like, I hate this character. He is fucking terrible. Because he's the main character, something happens in my mind where I just want to give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe we're not seeing all the good things he did. We're not seeing all of the orphans he saved from, you know, with his charitable donations, or all the church ladies he walked across the street. You know, the only reason we think he's so bad is because we're not seeing all the good. And it's just such an odd thing. You know, you, like, we're allowed to make movies where the main character is the bad guy. Mm-hmm. He's beyond saving. He's beyond either morally bankrupt enough to where we're not going to get a redemption arc. You're allowed to make a movie where you intentionally don't give a character a redemption arc. You know, but I always, I don't know. Maybe it's just wanting to see the good in people. Maybe it's wanting happy endings and not the Asian massage kind.
I was just going there. You beat me to it. Yeah.
But I don't know. Do you, I don't know that I explained that well.
No.
Do you ever kind of get that thing happening?
One of the things that I really like in a film, and I don't care if they're flawed characters, but I like to have a likable character or likable characters that I can enjoy. Now, when I first watched this, I want to say I watched it in the early 90s. When it first came out, I was too young to see it. I had watched all the Rocky films, which I, you know, up 1 through 4, I truly enjoy. And so it was kind of like, oh, yeah, I'm going to put this out. I just started getting into Scorsese. I had seen Color of Money, which is one of my favorite Scorsese films. So I was kind of getting into his back catalog, going through Mean Streets, which is a good film, and then put this on. And the first thing, positives that I'll say about it is Robert De Niro is kind of playing himself in a lot of films that you see him in. But he does play Jake LaMotta extremely well, the demeanor of the boxer. And like I said earlier, it kind of felt like one of Scorsese's mafia films because it has such ties to the Italian heritage, the mafia connections in boxing. So it almost felt like a gangster film, and it kind of is in a way. But his performance is great. You also have great performances by Kathy Moriarty and Joe Pesci. I thought they were both... Joe Pesci, of course, is good. Again, he plays pretty much the same character, but his character was very similar to me, like from Goodfellas, where he's the snap. Like when he beats the guy and with the taxi cab door, it's so similar to the scene in Goodfellas years later. But
Frank Vincent, a young Frank Vincent.
Yeah, exactly.
Rest in peace, Frank. Yeah.
But he was so close to being a made man. But the thing that, when I saw it in the 90s, I don't remember being as anxious as I was this time around. I think because when I was in my 20s, I could handle a character that was as flawed as Jake LaMotta is and actually kind of just watch the story unfold and wonder if he's going to beat Sugar Ray Robinson and win the middleweight championship. And so I never really, the fact of all the things he does, it didn't bother me back then. Now being the current age that I'm at and have seen so much of life, I don't really enjoy when a character is so self-destructive, so vile to the people around him. The dude just had massive, and again, a lot of boxers in certain areas and different professions can be very aggressive and have those demons that they deal with. But he was, I mean, the whole movie's kind of built around his flaws. And it's just, you never know when he's going to snap again.
And if there were redeeming qualities or you want a redemption because your flawed character has an addiction issue or it's something that feels put upon them or outside of their control or kind of whatever. But in this one, he's just a jealous, aggressive jerk. And like, no one did that to you. This isn't an outside influence that's causing you to act in a way that you otherwise wouldn't, you know, really kind, wonderful people who are affected by drug or alcohol addictions. And all of a sudden they're not the same person that you once knew, you know, the kind person, the honest, thoughtful person now is selfish and steals to support their habit. And, you know, all of those things. In a situation like that, where Jake LaMotta is not a jealous, aggressive person, but instead is someone who struggles with addiction and it's sabotaging his relationships and his, professional career. Maybe in a situation like that, he seems to be a candidate for redemption. And in this one, he doesn't.
Right.
Because it's his own thing. Not just Jake LaMotta, if you, whoever's listening to this, if you're a jealous, crazy person who flies off the handle all the time, it is your responsibility to figure out why and try to fix it. It's not just, oh, well, I guess if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve, like, you're the fucking worst. You know who says that?
Right.
People who are the fucking worst.
Yeah.
And so that was what was so hard for me, I think. I wanted to be pulled in the direction of compassion for him. I wanted to be pulled. I wanted to be shown. I wanted to, in some way, justify in my mind that I should root for this person, that I should want it to get better, that I should want him to have an epiphany, to apologize, to have a tearful reunion with his 15-year-old wife, you know, whatever. That he cheated on his existing wife with, you know, I mean, but it's none of that.
No.
He's awful. And because of that, I only want bad things to happen to him. I don't want him to have a successful personal life. I don't want him to have a successful career. I want him to get his ass beat by Sugar Ray Robinson, you know, and whoever else.
You know, it's one of these things. Cripples put a comment up there that makes a lot of sense. You know, Tyson went to prison. True. So we look at Tyson, if you look at the movie about Tyson, he did some awful things. You know, we know the Robin Givens, you know, rape and assault and all that. And we know other things he's been accused of. Where he is at today is far and away, miles away from the man that he was in his 20s and 30s when he had the world on a silver platter and he kind of spiraled out of control, had the wrong people that were managing him. And not that that's an excuse, but he had a lot of baggage. He had a lot of shit that he was dealing with. And we see that Tyson's kind of redemption arc, where he is now. He may have not have atoned for all of his past sins, but he's in a better place. It might have been a nice thing for the movie to focus on, because from what I understand is that later in life, Jake LaMotta became a very loving type person. Once he got away from boxing, once he was married like 7 times, but once he, you know, got away from that, people genuinely like being around him. He was funny. But when I look at that, people talk about his personality and things like that. I'm like, well, my dad was funny, but he used to beat the crap out of my mom every night. You know, didn't make him a great guy just because he can tell a few good jokes. So it is one of those things that I would have liked to, like you said, I think it's a really good point. By the time he goes to jail for, again, messing with a 15-year-old, 14-year-old, and he can't get himself out of it, and he gets thrown in, and he has the scene where he beats up the walls. It's just, you don't feel sorry for him. You know that he put himself there, and he did so many things that hurt the people that were closest to him. And him crying and being upset about it, it didn't affect me in any way. I don't know what the intention was, but it just didn't do anything for me. This viewing, maybe when I saw it in the 90s, when I saw it in the 90s, I was a big film geek and I loved the Scorsese way of filming. This movie watches like a student film almost. It has grittiness to it. It's very low budget looking. And so it focuses on these dialogue pieces. But I do have another problem with it, is I'm watching it today, and it seemed like there were so many scenes. And I'm like, excuse me? What do you say?
I realized halfway through I didn't have the captions on. And I turned the closed captioning on because I kept going, are they saying something? Or is it one of those like, what was that, Lost in Translation, where they whisper, but you're not supposed to know that they said something?
Yeah.
I was so confused by it.
There's so much mumbling. And I'm like, what was the intention behind that? Is that just the way they're reflecting how Italians you know, the group speak to one another because they kind of speak. Yeah, but it's so subdued. There's so many scenes with him and Pesci, and Pesci is a loud, boisterous personality. And there's a going, so when you're going to go to the thing, you're going to do the thing, you're going to go to the thing.
I already told you I'm not going to do that.
And how many times were there scenes that they just keep repeating the same thing over and over? Now, granted, that is part of the culture too. But, you know, what did you do with my wife? I didn't, how can you ask me that? And it just keeps going on and on. And it gets building. Now, granted, builds up the tension, but it was to a point after like 3 minutes of the same dialogue back and forth, I was kind of like, wow, this is a little repetitive.
So this is the reason why good script writing is so important.
Yeah.
Because as much as you can want a movie to seem as realistic as possible, and this one should, because it's telling the story of a real person,
yeah,
the real things that happened to him, you want an experienced, good script writer to write dialogue for these people, because dialogue in real life, as it happens in your daily life, is different than how it happens on screen, even when you're trying to do something that feels very authentic and genuine and realistic.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it was just trying very hard to write dialogue that sounds like it would really happen in real life. We really, you need to keep an eye on that, but you also need to write dialogue for a movie because it's a movie, you right. know? And I always appreciate that, because in, you know, these big action movies or whatever, you know, the things they say to one another when things are going haywire and what is not the things that you and I would say to each other as a truck blows up behind us and whatever. So you need it to be believable, feel authentic, but it can't just be the way we just talk in
right.
everyday normal life. There were volume issues. Now, again, I you brought up student film. I think that's really a very astute way of looking at it, because it felt like that. There's actually the scene you just talked about in the living room, when he's fixing the TV and he asks him, did you sleep with my wife? And Joe mm-hmm. Pesci says, how can you ask me that? And that's a really famous little monologue type thing. Well, one of them leaves, and then instead of it being a cut into a new shot, they just pan the camera and watch him leave, and then pan the camera back over to our character who was still just sitting on the couch. Yeah. That felt very student film to me.
Yeah.
It felt, now I read something, maybe you can clarify this for me, because I've always thought Scorsese's just always been a success, but I read something that made me believe that he believed that this was going to be his last film, or that he wasn't going to get another shot at making a big movie. Did you read anything about that, or do you know anything about that?
No, I really enjoy most of his films. I, you know, they're like early stuff. Mean Streets has got De Niro and Harvey Keitel in it, and it's a nice little gangster film, but it's not exceptional. You could see the beginnings there of a great, and then of course, then we have Taxi Driver, that's, you know, it, utterly insane. Of course, you know, Scorsese and De Niro worked together on so many different projects, and then this one came around, and knowing this film, I always thought it was a successful film, but just never really got into the mystique of it. My first experience with Scorsese was like really The Color of Money when I was in high school. And then I started like, oh yeah, I really like this style. And to me, like I said, this is not even my top five favorite Scorsese film.
Well, apparently it wasn't very successful when it came out in 1980.
Yeah.
And it's only kind of revisionist. Well, that's not revisionist history. I mean, you're allowed to, for things to develop over time, that, you know, importance develops over time, but it wasn't always seen as kind of a masterful top 10 movie of all time. You know, we can say, you know, it's Robert De Niro playing Robert De Niro, but Robert De Niro, I think, was a pretty unknown person at this time. Right.
Other than Taxi Driver and Mean Streets, things like that. He was just, this is 80. So Godfather 2. No, it was before this. So yeah, he had.
I just wonder if we think that it's De Niro playing De Niro because we have a whole
body
of work now of De Niro being De Niro, when maybe at the time, you know, he was relatively unknown, or maybe at the time it didn't seem so much
like
him playing himself.
Himself
is a formula for success, because we like that. He's done it enough.
Yeah.
It's proven its value in the movies. And I liked it. You know, when he's yelling out his window at his neighbor, you know, scenes like that were funny. I mean, you know, if I had a neighbor that did that to me, I wouldn't like it, but I'm watching a movie and I thought that was really funny. And he's threatening the guy's dog. But you know, then immediately turns around and wanting to beat the shit out of his wife for overcooking his steak. Yeah. You know, the guy really, every time you even think there might be something to this, something funny, something redeeming, every time he does something that only a complete and total psychopath would do.
Right.
And it, you know, you're like, oh, well, we were almost building up some goodwill here.
Like we said at the beginning, that this is a story that was told by Jake LaMotta, so we don't know 100% that's accurate. There's a whole arc of the story where he gets approached by the mafia because he cannot win a title fight without their connections, and there's a scene where they kind of work out where he's going to take a dive and then ends up taking the dive, and then afterwards, he doesn't do it in the way he should have. Which I think was one of the best parts with Joe Pesci. He just hit me, and he hits him, he falls on the ground. What's so hard about that? Why can't you do that? And so he's like, I'm not going to take a dive for anyone, but he does get, you know, the TKO, and then he bursts into tears because that was the one thing he was never going to do, and then he ends up getting suspended. And to me, it was like, okay, we got Jake LaMotta telling this story. Is that what really happened, or did he take the dive and wants everybody to think that he was this virtuous dude? If the dude is going to beat on people, beat on his brother, you know, actually go after a 15-year-old while he's still with his wife, why wouldn't we think he would throw a fight too, legitimately, to get a shot at the title? So
yeah, this was his one moral thing in a sea of immorality. I find it difficult to believe. Again, the reliability. I mean, listen, I thought there was no better punishment for him than, and maybe, you know, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but we see him later in the movie as a washed up, has been, you know, he's got his club in Miami and his jokes are cringeworthy. It feels like the audience is half there to see the spectacle of, you know, a train wreck that you can't peel your eyes away from, half personality cult of someone who used to have it and now they don't. I loved it. The movie starts with that too, though. Yes, he's rehearsing for his, I don't know, comedy, I guess. Yeah.
If one you man
call
show.
It that.
You know what's interesting is we were talking about Tyson earlier. It was brought up. Tyson did the same thing. He did the one man shows after he'd gotten out of prison to kind of bring him back to the audience and kind of humanize him a little bit. And I think that's, you know, LaMotta had his club, but then he goes and he does the 15-year-old girl thing again and gets thrown in jail. And it's like, dude, you were doing okay. You had your own nightclub. You were making a life for yourself, and you got to keep going down the same path over and over again.
And it's, I mean, and listen, you know, the whole scenario in itself is disgusting. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and you don't have to have a 15-year-old daughter to find it disgusting. I just do, even maybe more so because of that. But he's also so disgusting about it.
Yeah.
So blatantly, intentionally gross. Like, I just got chills. Just like, it's not just like, okay, I'm a grown man who likes little girls.
Yeah.
I just had to say it that way because they would have taken that clip on Jared Goes to the Movies and turned it into something that they play all the time. I'm a grown man who likes little girls. Yeah. it's not just that, which is gross, you know, be a pedo on your own time, but like that he's so slimy and why don't you prove to me you're 21 and so sleazy and gross, and he looks like he smells and he looks like he just he's exhausting as a character.
When he brings his Vicky to his own house and he's calling out for his wife to see if she's home, it's like, really, dude? And so, like I said, when I was in my 20s, whatever, you know, it's just that. But I was watching it today, go, you know, asking myself, are we supposed to think this is a romance? Because it really, it didn't, it seemed like an abusive, watching it in today's society, it seemed very extremely an abusive relationship where she continues to want to leave and he continues to, you know, restrain her from leaving. There's so many moments where she goes on this, this cycle of abuse where he continues to be nice and then smack her around again.
Well, yes.
And it's just, so I don't know if we as an audience were supposed to look at that as a love story, and maybe in 1980, that was some semblance of a what represented a love story.
I mean, I would like to think that in 1980, in a movie about events that happened from 41 to 60, whatever, that we still knew that grown ass men attempting to have romantic or sexual relationships with 15-year-old girls was predatory and wrong and manipulative and only works when terrible men find girls and twist things. You know, this, you'll often see this, you know, you're so mature for your age. You know, I don't like to hang out with girls my age, you know, but you're so much like, it's building a foundation of sleazy, false, you know, building someone up. It's manipulative. It's so grooming. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Using what you know as your experience advantage in life, your, you know, knowledge advantage, your charisma advantage, you know, whatever advantage you have, using it in such a underhanded way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just, okay, so I mean, we've well established it's hard to have any sympathy for this character, but characters that you don't have sympathy for can still make great movies.
Right.
So, taking out our personal, you know, visceral reactions to the character, I mean, what do you think about the way Scorsese tells this story? What do you think about the way this movie is presented to us as an audience?
Right. So we've mentioned a few of the cons of this film, and part of it is some of the under mumbling of the dialogue, some of the repetitive dialogue, and also the relationship issues that they have. Taking those cons aside and looking at the pros, one of the things that I thought was, it still think it's really captivating, is the actual boxing scenes themselves, is the way that the lighting and shading is done in certain scenes, like you see on this slide here with the Sugar Ray Robinson when he gets ready to lay him out. The whole sequence with the second fight with Sugar Ray was done really intensely. I thought a lot of the fights where he fights the kid Gennaro, who his wife says is a good-looking kid, and then he beats him to a pulp, and the guy goes, well, he ain't good-looking no more. Things like that were, there were moments that bring you back to the film, and it is like a true Scorsese type. So if you're a fan of Scorsese, by all means, I would say this is a recommended film to watch. Just be prepared for the unlikability of the lead, or depending on how you see things in life, maybe you love the guy. But it's entertaining. That's without a doubt. It's just it's just those things that kind of hold it back for me, make it lesser entertaining than some of Scorsese's other films. Because look, if you look at Goodfellas, which I think is probably maybe his best. Now, I like Color of Money, but I wouldn't argue that it's his best. I just like it because of the subject matter, and I like Tom Cruise and Paul Newman, and I think they're great. But Goodfellas, literally, you can watch that again and again. Ray Liotta is a flawed character in that film. He does stupid things, but yet he's so much more likable than Jake LaMotta is in Raging Bull. You still root for him, even though he's a freaking screw-up. And so that makes it more entertaining for me. I think having that character that you can't get around it. So even if you take it out, there's so many things to enjoy about the film, but it's still hard to get around it on the likability.
Do you think that because you bring up a good point, I don't know that I've seen a Scorsese film, and obviously I haven't seen as many of them as you have, where most, if not all, of the characters, and especially the main characters, are very flawed. Now, part of it is he goes back to some of the same subject matter pretty often. But regardless, he has a reputation for this. I guess it's part of his thing. Would this story be better told if, and again, I know that we're working off of a real person, a real person's autobiography, you know, so we have to stay true to what's, you know, what the source material is. But I wonder, and I'm just wondering out loud, talking about it with you, if this movie isn't more successful in our minds with a character who is developed to have a little more sympathy, to have a little more realistic feeling heart. You know, I like to think that not everybody is all good and not everybody is all bad. That's just the way it is, you know. And, you know, Hitler really loved his dogs, right? But it just makes me wonder if we had a character and if Scorsese had taken either the care or just taken the direction of making him a little more appealing, if we would think differently about the film. I don't know if we would or wouldn't, but it does make me wonder.
I enjoyed it. I it's hard not to enjoy it just as a piece of art, but there is something to be said for, like we talked about, the way it ends. There's no redemption, and we know that, you know, later in life, but we don't get that. We don't get the full, you know, act of his life and all the way to where he got to this point, and then he did turn things around. We never get that. So we just get all the bad. He never becomes a character that seems to regret any of his choices. He really doesn't.
Maybe that's one scene, and we get the crying scene when he throws a fight, but we already question the motive there. Even one other scene where he even comes close to acting like he was sorry for things that he did, where he recognized that for whatever reason, his decision making is bad. We also don't get anything by way of the story of his life leading up to a boxing career. Like you said, Greg, you know, about which, you know, is chilling to hear you say, but, you know, about your father like, you know, so we don't get anything by way of, and I had a family member who was very, very abusive. And of course I didn't know that when I was, I can talk about my mother's dad, who I just knew as my granddad, who was an old man when I knew him, who sat in his easy chair with his two chihuahuas and just was funny and liked to go fishing, was a horrible, horrible person to my mother growing up, to my mother, my grandmother. But I didn't know that. And we don't know that about Jake LaMotta. We know nothing about what causes this jealousy? What causes this rage, this anger? And maybe that's not important to the story, but it would be important if you're trying to figure out a way to find something likable about him, to figure out maybe, you know, when I think about Mike Tyson, it is hard to discuss things like the career and history of Mike Tyson without sounding like a rape apologist or someone right. who, it's just difficult to do that. It's hard to say the man has done everything with this in his power to obviously be different, to take responsibility for the things he did, for all these things, because someone got raped. It ruined someone's fucking life. And so it's hard to have that discussion. So it would still be hard with Jake LaMotta if we knew that he had some sort of awful upbringing, if we knew he had been abused, if we knew the only male role model he ever saw was a jealous, angry person. So of course that's how he turns out. Any number of things could establish why he is. And I guess that only serves the benefit for us to try to find something better about him than he really is. And maybe that's not the story that Scorsese wanted to tell, you know?
True.
I don't know.
They never like reconciles with his brother. He has a moment where he tries to call him, but then he just listens. And then there's a scene where he cries in the jail, but is he crying because he's in jail or is he crying because he's really regretting? It's ambiguous, but you can assume that that's what he's upset for, where his life has turned or where it's taken him. But it wasn't enough for me to really connect to the character or enjoy it. Now, as a film overall, like I said, there's performances that are very enjoyable. The filming is unique. The boxing scenes, you know, we know Scorsese is a great director, though. We know that he's capable of even with a black and white film, catching your eye with certain moments, the things that kind of keep drawing you to the film. But I don't know if the sum is greater, the sum of the whole film is greater than its parts. I just don't know. So
for some people, it must be. I mean, you know, we are still talking, like Lawrence Arabia, about a film that is in the top eight of the AFI that people, I think probably more people than not, consider this to be Scorsese's opus. It is his movie in the top 10.
It was nominated for several Oscars. Robert De Niro did win, but Ordinary People won the best, which I'm not a big fan of that film either, but it won that year for 1980. So it made its mark. It was respected at the time. It was, as far as critically acclaimed, it was always been critically acclaimed. But yeah, I mean, everybody has an opinion. It's funny because I started looking at the entire AFI list and just going down past number eight, and I'm like, oh, I like that better. I like this better. You know, Apocalypse Now is in there. I'm like, I would put Apocalypse Now over this. But again, that list is made by AFI. We're kind of going along with that and to see out of their top eight, which we think is the best. And so we're almost done with the first round. All that's left is just to vote and see who that we want to get into that final four.
I will say just briefly about Raging Bull, one of the things that I found very enjoyable about it in a film that is devoid of all joy was the use of like orchestral music and instrumentation alongside like very brutal boxing scenes. It was such a, and we've seen this before. It's almost kind of something you expect to see now, but this was 1980, and it was really an interesting way to present that part of the story. So that was just something I had written down as in a movie that I think had more, I don't know if it had more negatives, but it didn't have enough positives to overcome the negatives, but that was one of the positives for me.
Yeah, I think the boxing sequences are really, like, even if I was kind of lapsing in attention, when the boxing sequences would happen, my attention would pick up. And it was part of that was the slow-mo, the way they framed the fighters' movements, the close-ups to certain area where they squeeze in the sponge and it's filled with blood. It's those are striking images, and they do it. He does it really well as far as that goes. It, like I said, it's filmed exceptionally well, and yeah, the use of music is done really well. But it is as far as the pantheon of film history, it has its place, and there's reasons people like it more than others in the Scorsese library, and I totally get it. I look at films, like I said before, of, am I going to order that again? Am I going to watch that again? And so, like with Schindler's List, where I like it, and I just don't see myself watching it again and again. Uncomfortableness does have a place in cinema and can create an enjoyable film. It's just, is that what we want to subject ourselves to? Because I've seen films that make me feel very uncomfortable, but I would watch again. Like The Godfather has moments like that. The Scarface has moments like that where they're very uncomfortable, but I would watch them again because of the way they're framed, the way that the dialogue is written, the way the scenes are done. They're very entertaining. And so, but this one to me, I don't see myself watching again for a long time. I'm good for that. I will watch Color of Money. I'll watch Goodfellas. I'll watch Casino. I'll even watch 4 hours of The Irishman maybe one day.
Have you not seen that one?
I have. And okay. I'm saying watching it again. That's the only thing that would hold me back from watching it again is just because of the running time. But
yeah,
overall, it does earn its place. I'm not quite sure I would have it in the top eight of all time, but it's here. So I'm going to go ahead and let you vote first of these two, and we'll decide a winner.
Yeah, I mean, I should clarify. I didn't not enjoy this movie. It's hard to say I enjoyed it, but I'm not trying to put across that I found it a bad movie. I think for me, Greg, and this is just a personal preference. I'm not sure the more that I watch these movies like this, that are kind of outside my wheelhouse, I think I'm starting to realize that I don't necessarily watch a movie to be challenged, to feel uncomfortable, to be put in a position where I really have to fight through what I do and don't feel about the situation or the character or whatever it is. And I know the way that each of these two movies made me feel. I know the frame of mind that each of these movies put me in. I know how they affected me. I'm voting for Singin' in the Rain. It brought me so much joy, unexpected joy, because I wasn't sure what I was getting into. I like musicals, and okay, films that are 70 year olds can be good. We've seen some of them over the last few weeks. But I didn't go into it expecting to have a blast, to be tickled and entertained and just really good. It's Singin' in the Rain for me, probably by a very wide margin, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I would agree. I've already talked about my love for Singin' in the Rain, and it's funny because if you were not familiar with this film and you haven't seen it, you're kind of missing out. It is a hidden gem from a bygone era, and it's probably, out of all the musicals they could have picked to put in the top eight, it's probably the most fun you're going to have watching an old musical.
I was really pleased that I knew I would have moments like this when I started with Jarrett's movie podcast and when we were doing this, because I've seen so few movies. I knew there were going to be little gems in there that just really socked me. Hateful Eight was one that I would have never seen had it not been for participating in a movie review podcast that I was like, it made watching 300 other films that I may not have liked really worthwhile. And this is another one of those for me.
That's good. Yeah.
I would have never watched this ever had we not decided that we were going to do a show and that the format was going to be this and that we were going to start with this set of eight movies. I'd never have seen this film, and I'd be worse off for it, because it was just It's just so great. This goes into like a top 10 movie for me.
Oh, nice. Nice.
It was so, I could watch this as often as it came across on TV, like I do with Shawshank Redemption, like I do with any of the original Star Wars movies, like I do with Legally Blonde. This will be another one of those.
Fantastic. I would say, yeah, top 10 for me as well. There's others I would recommend. I would definitely recommend Brigadoon if you like that. Gene Kelly, it's again another sidekick. The Scottish theme is great. It's got a really good story, and it's got a good love story. It's Sid Charisse is the female lead. So I'd recommend that if we get down that road. Maybe we'll do a musical category. But right now we're still doing the AFI's top eight. And so now with Singing in the Rain in the final four, this is our final four greatest films of all time. Our next show, I have Sunday, 20 August. I don't think that's the 20th.
I think whenever it is.
Yeah, it's the 20th of August, which is a Tuesday. We're back on Tuesday. So a little bit over a week, we are going to do the final four matchups all in one night because we've already discussed these films. Mm-hmm. So we're going to need the audience's support and help for any ties that need to be broken, especially once we get down to the final two. So looking at this list, it could be very difficult between the two of us to come to a decision. Now, that being said, I do want to make a couple of announcements so that the audience will know what we've got coming up. We've got some really exciting things happening on Box Office Battles. After this category, we have already decided on our next category, Eric and I, and it is going to be adult-oriented sports comedies, the eight best. So we were gonna, when we do this final show for the final four of this category, we will announce the eight movies that are going to be in the sports comedy category that we're going to do. I also can confirm that during the sports comedy segments that we're going to be doing in the upcoming weeks, we're going to have a couple of special guests join us to help us break ties. One of them is our dear friend Sean from the Jarrett Goes to the Movies podcast, who is very anxious to join us for an episode. So we're going to work that out. And another one is our beloved Rob from Bowling for Soup. Was able to see him in Columbus after the soup show there. Got to hang out with him and talk movies because he had heard about our podcast. And he asked if he could be on it. We talked about Star Wars for like 20 minutes. It was hilarious because
he's a big Star Wars guy.
He loves Empire Strikes Back. And so when I told him we were going to do sports comedies, he was all on board. He's like, oh, I've got to be in on that. So
Mike, the reason that Greg said adult oriented, it's not because they're sexual in nature. It's because we don't want to watch The Sandlot and Little Giants and Bad News Bears and Mighty Ducks. So that is the only reason. He said, go Mighty Ducks. So I'm like, no.
Yeah.
That's why we're not. I don't want to watch a bunch of kids. I forget what else was on there, but I was like, man, I don't want to watch those.
Well, we looked at everything, the list as it was, and it was like, Bad News Bears. I think Bad News Bears is like PG, but it is kind of adult-oriented. But we really wanted it to be those kind of films that we really enjoy that kind of break the kind of the rules as far as that. Like Major League is definitely in the list. No spoilers. We won't say the entire list right now, but once we finish this, that is our next category that we're getting into. So if you have a category that you'd like us to get into, we're taking suggestions right now. We have a few in mind for upcoming segments after that. We've talked about doing a So Bad They're Good category. And we have some others as well. We've also talked about doing a category where we discuss the top eight movies of fictional bands that never existed, like Spinal Tap or the Uneaters from That Thing You Do and others. So if you have one, you can just always reach out to us at our email address at boxofficebattles, it's spelled just like it said, @gmail.com. You can also go to our Twitch page, our YouTube page, or our Facebook page, and you can leave suggestions there as well. We're more than happy to take them on any of our sites. So, that being said, we have a final four established for a week and a half from now that we're going to kind of break down and figure out what is the AFI's greatest movie of all time. You excited for that?
I am. Yeah. And obviously all four of my movies made it into the final four. So.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah. I was most excited about that.
That is true. I did not think about that. Very good. That's awesome. So, yeah. You got your man,
Greg, fun times as always. I appreciate you. And, the rest of you guys, until next time, y'all be excellent to each other.
Same here. We're excited to have you a part of the audience, and we're glad that you keep coming back each and every week, whether it's on the podcast providers. We're on Spotify, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, Pandora, whatever provider you're using. Make sure that you subscribe so you always get up to date on when the next episode is going to be launched. We try to have these out after the live stream within a couple days. Just takes a little bit of editing prowess to get all the goofiness that we can get on there and get it onto your podcast provider. So thank you so much for being a part of this. And we will see you again on the 20th of August, where we will have a winner of AFI's top 8 films of all time. Good night, everyone.